I turned my body slightly toward Lisa Trammell and gestured to her. She is perfectly aware of this tactic and agrees. She is also willing to go on record if you wish to ask her directly. I don't think that is necessary. How does the state feel about this? Freeman looked suspicious, like she was looking for the trap. Judge, she said, I want it clear that the defendant is acknowledging that the blood found on the hammer was indeed Mitchell Bondurant's blood, and I want a waiver on ineffective counsel. I don't think a waiver is necessary, Perry said, but I will get the stipulation directly from the defendant. He then asked Lisa questions that confirmed she was on board with the stipulation. Once Freeman said she was satisfied, Perry turned his chair and rolled to the end of the bench so he could address the jury. Ladies and gentlemen, the witness was going to take you through an explanation of the science of DNA typing and matching, leading you to testimony in regard to lab tests, matching blood found on the hammer that is in evidence to that of our victim, Mitchell Bondurant. By stipulating, the defense is saying they agree with those findings and will not object to them. So what you take from this is that the blood found on the handle of the hammer, found in the bushes near the bank, did indeed come from the victim, Mitchell Bondurant. This is now stipulated as a proven fact, and I will have that in writing for you when you begin your deliberations. He nodded once, and then rolled back into place where he told Freeman to proceed. Knocked out of rhythm by my unexpected move, she asked the judge for a few moments while she got her bearings and found the place from which to restart her examination. Finally, she looked up at her witness. Okay, Dr. Stanley, the blood from the hammer was not the only sample of blood from this case that you were asked to have analyzed, correct? That is correct. We were also given a separate sample of blood discovered on a shoe found on the defendant's premises. In the garage, I believe. We typed, Your Honor, I said as I rose from my seat again. Once more, the defense wishes to stipulate. This time, the move brought complete silence to the courtroom. Nobody was whispering in the gallery. The bailiff wasn't using his hand to muffle his voice on his telephone. The court reporter's fingers were held steady over the keys. Complete silence. The judge had been sitting with the fingers of both hands knitted together beneath his chin. He held his pose for a long moment before using both hands to signal Freeman and me forward to the bench. Come on up here, counsel. Freeman and I stood side by side in front of the bench. The judge whispered, Mr. Holler, your reputation preceded you when you came into my courtroom on this case. I was told by more than one source that you were a damn fine lawyer and a tireless advocate. I need to ask, however, if you know what you're doing here. You want to stipulate to the prosecution's contention that the victim's blood was found on your client's own shoe. Are you sure about that, Mr. Holler? I nodded, as if to concede that he had made a good point in questioning my trial strategy. Judge, we did the analysis ourselves, and it came back as a match. The science doesn't lie, and the defense is not interested in trying to mislead the court or the jury. If a trial is a search for truth, then let the truth come out. The defense stipulates, we will prove later that the blood was planted on the shoe. That is where the real truth lies, not with whether or not it was his blood. We acknowledge that it was, and we're ready to move on. Your Honor, may I be heard? Freeman said. Go ahead, Miss Freeman. The state objects to the stipulation. She had finally caught on. The judge looked aghast. I don't understand, Miss Freeman. You get what you want. The victim's blood on the defendant's shoes. Your Honor, Dr. Stanley is my last witness. Counsel is seeking to undercut the state's case by robbing me of the ability to present evidence in the way I wish to present it. This witness's testimony is devastating to the defense. He just wants to stipulate to lessen its impact on the jury. But a stipulation must be agreed to by both parties. I made a mistake taking the stipulation on the hammer, but not this time. Not on the shoes. The state objects to this. the judge, was undaunted. He saw a savings of at least a half day of court time, and he wasn't going to let it go. Counsel, understand that the court can overrule your objection in the cause of judicial economy. I'd rather not do that. He was telling her not to go against him on this, to accept the stipulation. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but the state still objects. Overruled. You can step back. And so it went. As with the hammer, the judge relayed the stipulation to the jury and promised they would receive a document outlining the evidence and facts agreed to by the start of deliberations. I had successfully silenced the crescendo of the prosecution's case. Instead of going out with the crashing of cymbals, drums, and evidence that screamed, "She did it, she did it, she did it," the prosecution went out with a whimper. Freeman was seething. She knew how important the payoff was to the gradual build-up. You don't listen to Bolero for 10 minutes and turn it off with the final 2 minutes to go. Not only did the truncating of her case hurt, but I had effectively turned her last and most important witness into the first witness for the defense. By stipulating, I had made it seem as if the DNA returns were the initial building blocks of my case. And there was nothing Freeman could do. She had put the whole case out and had nothing left. After excusing Stanley from the witness stand, she sat at the prosecution table, turning through her notes, probably thinking about whether she should put Curlin or Longstreth back on the stand to finish the case with a detective's roundup of all the evidence. But there were risks to that. She had rehearsed their testimony before, but not this time. "Ms. Freeman," the judge finally asked, "do you have another witness?" Freeman looked over at the jury box. She had to believe she had the verdict. So what if the evidence wasn't delivered according to the plan she had choreographed? The evidence was still there and in the record. The Vic's blood on the hammer and on the defendant's shoes. It was more than enough. She had the verdict in her pocket. She slowly rose, still looking at the jurors. Then she turned and addressed the judge. "Your Honor, the people rest." It was a solemn moment, and again the courtroom turned still and silent, this time for almost a whole minute. "Very well," the judge finally said. "I don't think any of us thought we would be at this place so soon. Mr. Holler, are you ready to proceed with the presentation of the defense's case?" I stood. "Your Honor, the defense is ready to proceed." The judge nodded. He still seemed a bit shell-shocked by the defense's decision to acknowledge and accept as evidence the victim's blood on the defendant's shoes. "Then we'll take our afternoon break a little early," he said. "And when we come back, the defense phase will begin." Part 4. The Fifth Witness. Chapter 39. If the defense tactics during the latter stages of the prosecution's case were surprising, the first step out of the corner during the defense phase did nothing to lessen some observers' doubts as to the competence of counsel. Once everyone was back in place following the afternoon break, I went to the lectern and threw another what-the-hell move into the trial. The defense calls the defendant, Lisa Trammell. The judge asked for quiet as my client stood and made her way to the stand. That she was called at all was shocking and caused a roll of whispers and chatter in the courtroom. As a general rule, defense attorneys don't like to put a client on the witness stand. In a risk-to-reward ratio, this tactic ranks quite low. You can never be sure what your client will say, because you can never fully believe anything she has told you. And to be caught in a single lie, while under oath and on the stand, in front of the 12 people determining your guilt or innocence, is devastating. But this time, and this case, were different. Lisa Trammell had never wavered in her claim to innocence. She had never once waffled in her response to the evidence against her, and she had never once been remotely interested in any sort of deal. Given this, and the developments regarding the Herb Dahl-Lewis Aparicio connection, I was viewing her differently than I had at the start of the trial. She insisted on having the chance to tell the jury she was innocent, and it occurred to me the night before that she should be given the opportunity the very moment it became available. She would be the first witness. The defendant took the oath with a slight smile on her face. It may have seemed out of place to some. After she was seated and her name was in the record, I jumped right on it. "Lisa, I just saw you smiling a little bit when you were taking the oath to tell the truth. Why were you smiling?" "Oh, you know, nervousness and relief."
"Relief?"
"Yes, relief. I finally get the chance to tell my side, to tell the truth." It had started out well. From there, I quickly took her through the standard list of basic questions about who she was, what she did for a living, and the state of her marriage, as well as touching on the state of her home ownership. "Did you know the victim of this terrible crime, Mitchell Bondurant?"
"Know him? No. Know of him? Yes."
"What do you mean by that?"
"Well, over the past year or so, when I started to get in trouble with the mortgage, I had seen him. I went to the bank a couple times to plead my case to him. They never let me talk to him, but I saw him back there in his office. The wall of his office was completely made of glass, which was a joke. Like you could see him, but not talk to him."
I checked the jury. I didn't see any outright head nods, but I thought the answer and the image my client had conjured were perfect. The banker hiding behind a wall of glass, while the downtrodden and disadvantaged are kept away.
"Did you ever see him anywhere else?"
"On the morning of the murder, I saw him at the coffee shop I stop at. He was two people behind me in line. That's why I was confused when I was talking to the detectives. They were asking about Mr. Bondurant, and I had just seen him that morning. I didn't know he was dead. I didn't realize they were investigating me for a murder I didn't know had even been committed."
So far, so good. She was playing it as we had discussed and rehearsed, right down to always referring to the victim with complete respect, if not sympathy. "Did you talk to Mr. Bondurant that morning?"
"No, I didn't. I was afraid he might think I was stalking him or something and take me to court. Also, I had been warned by you to avoid any encounter or confrontation with people from the bank. So I quickly got my coffee and left."
"Lisa, did you kill Mr. Bondurant?"
"No, of course not."
"Did you sneak up behind him with the hammer from your garage and hit him on the head so hard that he was dead before he hit the ground?"
"No, I did not."
"Did you hit him two more times when he was on the ground?"
"No."
I paused as if to study my notes. I wanted her denials to echo in the courtroom and in each juror's mind. "Lisa, you made quite a name for yourself fighting the foreclosure of your home, didn't you?"
"It wasn't my intention. I just wanted to keep my home for myself and my son. I did what I thought was right. It ended up getting a lot of attention."
"It wasn't good attention for the bank, was it?" Freeman objected, arguing that I was asking Trammell a question she would not have the knowledge to answer. The judge agreed and told me to ask something else. "There came a time when the bank sought to stop your protests and other activities, correct?"
"Yes, they took me to court and got a restraining order against me. I couldn't have any more protests at the bank, so I had them at the courthouse."
"And did people join your cause?"
"Yes, I started a website and hundreds of people, a lot of them like me, losing their homes, joined in."
"You became quite visible as the leader of this group, didn't you?"
"I guess so. But it was never about getting attention for myself. It was about what they were doing, the frauds they were committing when they took away people's houses and condos and everything."
"How many times do you think you were on the television news or in the newspaper?"
"I didn't keep count, but a few times I went national. I was on CNN and Fox."
"By the way, speaking of going national, Lisa, on the morning of the murder, did you walk by Westland National in Sherman Oaks?"
"No, I didn't."
"That wasn't you on the sidewalk, just a half block away."
"No, it was not."
"So the woman who testified she saw you was lying under oath?"
I don't want to call anyone a liar, but it wasn't me. Maybe she just made a mistake.
Thank you, Lisa. I looked down at my notes and shifted directions. By seemingly keeping my own client off guard with changing subjects and questions, I was in effect keeping the jury off guard, which is what I wanted to do. I didn't want them thinking ahead of me. I wanted their undivided attention, and I wanted to feed them the story in pieces and in an order of my choosing. Do you normally keep your garage door locked? I asked.
Yes, always.
Why is that?
Well, it's not attached to the house. You have to go outside the house to go in the garage. So I always have the door locked. I have mostly junk in there, but some stuff is valuable. My husband always treated the tools like they were precious. And I have the helium tank for balloons and parties, and I don't want any of the older kids in the neighborhood to get into that. And, well, I once read about somebody who had a detached garage like mine, and she never locked her door. And then one day, she went into the garage and a man was in there stealing stuff. He raped her. So I always keep the door locked.
Do you have any idea why it was unlocked when the police searched your home on the day of the murder?
No, I always kept it locked.
When was the last time before this trial that you saw the hammer from your workbench in its place in the garage?
I don't remember ever seeing it. My husband was the one who had all the tools set up in there. I'm not really good with tools.
What about gardening tools?
Well, I take that back if you mean tools like that. I do the gardening and those are my tools.
Do you have any idea how a micro dot of blood from Mr. Bondurant ended up on one of your gardening shoes? Lisa stared forward with a troubled look on her face. Her chin wavered slightly as she spoke.
I don't know. There's no explanation. I hadn't worn those shoes in a long time, and I didn't kill Mr. Bondurant.
Her last line was spoken almost as a plea. It carried a sense of desperation and truth. I paused to savor it, and hoped the jurors had noted it as well. After that, I spent another half hour with her, working mostly the same themes and denials. I got into more details about her coffee shop encounter with Bondurant, as well as the foreclosure process and the hopes she had of winning the case. Her purpose in the defense case was threefold. I needed her denial and explanations on record. I needed her personality to engender sympathy from the jury and put a human face on a case about murder. And finally, I needed to have the jurors start to wonder if this diminutive and seemingly fragile woman could lie in wait and then forcefully swing a hammer at a man's head. Three times. By the time I came to the end of the direct examination, I felt I had gone a long way toward accomplishing all three of these goals. I tried to go out with a little crescendo of my own.
Did you hate Mitchell Bondurant? I asked.
I hated what he and his bank were doing to me and others like me. But I didn't hate him personally. I didn't even know him.
But you had lost your marriage, and you had lost your job, and now you were in danger of losing your house. Didn't you wish to lash out at the forces you believed were hurting you?
I was already lashing out. I was protesting my mistreatment. I had hired a lawyer and was fighting the foreclosure. Yes, I was angry, but I wasn't violent. I am not a violent person. I'm a school teacher. I was lashing out, if you have to use those words, in the only way I knew, peacefully protesting something that was wrong. Very definitely wrong.
I glanced at the jury and thought I caught a woman in the back row wiping away a tear. I hope to God she was. I turned back to my client and moved in for the big closing. I ask you once again, Lisa, did you kill Mitchell Bondurant?
No, I didn't.
Did you take a hammer and strike him with it in the garage at the bank?
No, I wasn't there. It wasn't me.
Then how was the hammer from your garage used to kill him?
I don't know.
How was his blood found on your shoes?
I don't know. I didn't do it. I was set up.
I paused for a moment and calmed my voice before finishing. One last question, Lisa. How tall are you?
She looked confused, like a rag doll that had been pulled one way and then the other.
What do you mean?
Just tell us how tall you are.
I'm 5'3".
Thank you, Lisa. I have nothing further.
Freeman had her work cut out for her.
Lisa Trammell had been a solid witness, and the prosecutor wasn't going to break her. She tried in a few places to get contradictory responses, but Lisa more than held her own. After a half hour of Freeman trying to break down a door with a toothpick, I began to think my client was going to sail through. But it never pays to think you're safe until your client is off the stand and sitting next to you. Freeman had at least one card up her sleeve, and she eventually played it. When Mr. Haller asked you a little while ago if you had committed this crime, you said you were not violent. You said you were a school teacher and that you weren't violent. Do you remember that?
Yes, it's true.
But isn't it true that you were forced to change schools and undergo anger management treatment 4 years ago when you struck a student with a three-sided ruler?
I quickly stood and objected and asked for a sidebar. The judge allowed us to approach.
Judge, I whispered before Perry even asked, there's nothing in any of the discovery about a three-sided ruler. Where's this coming from?
Judge, Freeman whispered before Perry even asked, it's new information that just came to us late last week. We had to verify it.
Oh, come on, I said. You're going to say you didn't have her full teaching record from the get-go? You expect us to believe that?
You can believe whatever you want, Freeman responded. We didn't offer it in discovery because I had no intention of bringing it up until your client started testifying about her nonviolent history. This obviously puts a lie to that and has become fair game.
I turned my attention back to Perry. Judge, her excuse doesn't matter. She's not playing by the rules of discovery. The question should be stricken and she should not be allowed to pursue this line of questioning.
Judge, this is...
Counsel is right, Ms. Freeman. You can save it for rebuttal provided you come up with the witnesses, but you're not going to bring it in here. It should have been part of discovery.
We returned to our positions. I would now have to put Sisko on the incident, because no doubt Freeman would be bringing it up again later. This annoyed me, because one of the first assignments I had given Sisko when we got the case was to completely vet our client. This event had somehow been missed. The judge instructed the jury to disregard the prosecutor's question, and then told Freeman to proceed with a different line of questioning. But I knew that bell had been rung loud and clear for the jury. The question might have been wiped from the record, but not from their minds. Freeman went on with her cross-examination, pot-shotting Trammell here and there, but not penetrating the armor of her direct testimony. My client could not be shaken from her contention that she was not walking near Westland National on the morning of the murder. With the exception of the three-sided ruler, it was a damn good start, because it put the jury on immediate notice that we were engaged in an affirmative defense. We would not be going down without a fight. The prosecutor took it right on up to 5 o'clock, thus preserving the ability to come up with something overnight and hit Trammell with it in the morning. The judge recessed for the evening, and everybody was sent home, except for me. I was heading back to the office. There was still more to do. Before leaving the courtroom, I huddled with my client at the defense table and whispered angrily to her.
Thanks for telling me about the three-sided ruler. What else don't I know?
Nothing. That was stupid.
What was stupid? That you hit a kid with a ruler, or that you didn't tell me?
It was 4 years ago and he deserved it. That's all I'm going to say about it.
It's not going to be your choice. Freeman can still bring it up on rebuttal, so you better start thinking about what you're going to say.
A look of concern creased her face.
How can she? The judge told the jury to forget it was brought up.
She can't bring it up on cross, but she'll find a way to bring it up later. There are different rules about rebuttal, so you'd better tell me all about it, and anything else I should know but you've neglected to tell me. She glanced over my shoulder, and I knew she was looking for Herb Dahl. She had no idea what Dahl had revealed to me, or about the double agent work he was doing.
"Dahl isn't here," I said. "Talk to me, Lisa. What else should I know?"
When I got back to the office, I found Sisko in the reception area, hands in his pockets and chatting up Lorna, who was behind the front desk.
"What's going on?" I demanded. "I thought you were going to the airport to get Shammy."
"I sent Bullocks," Sisko said. "She got her and is on the way back."
"She should have stayed here preparing for her testimony, which will probably come tomorrow. You're the investigator. You should have gone to the airport. Both of them together probably can't carry the dummy."
"Relax, boss. They got it covered. And they're fine together. Bullocks just called from the road. So you keep your cool and we'll do the rest."
I stared hard at him. I didn't care if he was 6 inches taller and 75 more pounds of muscle. I'd had it. I'd been carrying everything, and I'd had it.
"You want me to relax? You want me to be cool? Fuck you, Sisko. We just started the defense, and the problem is, we don't have a defense. I have a lot of talk and a dummy. The problem is, unless you get your hands out of your fucking pockets and find me something, I'm the one who's going to look like the dummy. So don't tell me to be cool, okay? I'm the one who's standing in front of the jury every fucking day."
First Lorna burst out laughing, and soon Sisko followed.
"You think this is funny?" I said in full outrage. "It's not funny. What the fuck makes it so fucking funny?"
Sisko held up his hands in a calming gesture until he could contain himself.
"Sorry, boss. It's just that when you get yourself worked up, and that thing about the dummy..."
This made Lorna start another cycle of laughter. I made a mental note to fire her after the trial. In fact, I'd fire them both. That would really be funny.
"Look," Sisko said, apparently sensing I wasn't picking up on the humor of the situation. "Go into your office, take your tie off, and sit down in the big chair. I'll go get my stuff and I'll show you what I've got working. I've been dealing with Sacramento all day, so the going is slow, but I'm getting close."
"Sacramento? The state crime lab?"
"No, corporate records. Bureaucrats, Mickey. That's why it's taking forever. But you don't have to worry. You do your job, and I'll do mine.
Kind of hard to do my job when I'm waiting on you to do yours."
I headed toward my office. I threw a baleful look at Lorna as I went by. It only served to make her laugh again.
Chapter 40. I was uninvited and unexpected. But having not seen my daughter in a week, I'd had to cancel Wednesday night pancakes because of the trial, and leaving things last time on a rough note with Maggie, I felt compelled to drop by the home they shared in Sherman Oaks. Maggie opened the door with a frown, apparently after seeing me through the peephole. "Bad night for surprise visitors, Holler," she said. "Well, I'll just visit Haley for a bit, if that's okay."
"She's the one having the bad night."
She stepped back and to the side to allow me to enter.
"Really?" I said. "What's the problem?"
"She's got a ton of homework and she doesn't want to be bothered by anyone, even me." I looked from the entry area into the living room but didn't see my daughter.
"She's in her room with the door closed. Good luck. I'll be cleaning up in the kitchen."
She left me there and I looked up the stairs. Haley's bedroom was up there, and all at once the climb looked forbidding. My daughter was a teenager, and subject to all the mood swings that come with that designation. You never knew what you were going to get. I made the journey anyway, and my polite knock on her bedroom door was greeted with a,
"What?"
"It's Dad. Can I come in?"
"Dad, I have a ton of homework."
"So that means I can't come in?"
"Whatever."
I opened the door and stepped in. She was in the bed and under the covers. She was surrounded by binders, books, and a laptop.
"And you can't kiss me. I have zit cream on."
I came to the side of the bed and leaned down. I managed to kiss her on the top of the head before the arm came up to push me away. "How much more have you got?"
"I told you, tons."
The math book was open and face down so she wouldn't lose her place. I picked it up to see what the lesson was.
"Don't lose my spot." sheer panic, end-of-the-world angst in her voice. "Don't worry, I've been handling books going on 40 years now." As far as I could tell, the lesson was about equations assigning values to X and Y, and I was completely lost. They were teaching her things beyond my reach. It was too bad it was stuff she'd never use. "Boy, I couldn't help you even if I wanted to."
"I know, neither can Mom. I'm all alone in the world."
"Aren't we all?"
I realized that she hadn't looked up at me once since I'd been in the room.
It was depressing.
"Well, I just wanted to say hi. I'll leave now." "Bye, I love you."
Still no eye contact.
"Good night."
I closed the door behind me and went down to the kitchen. The other female, who seemed to be able to control my mood at her whim, was sitting on a stool at the breakfast counter. She had a glass of Chardonnay in front of her and an open file. She at least looked up at me. She didn't smile, but she made eye contact, and I took that as a victory in this home. Her eyes then went back to the file.
"What are you working on?"
"Oh, just refreshing. I have a prelim tomorrow on a strong arm, and I haven't really looked at it since I filed it." The usual grind of the justice system. She didn't offer me a glass of wine because she knew I didn't drink. I leaned against the counter opposite the breakfast bar.
"So I'm thinking of running for district attorney," I said.
Her head shot up, and she looked at me.
"What?"
"Nothing, just trying to get somebody's attention around here."
"Sorry, but it's a busy night. I've got to work."
"Yeah, well, I'll go. Your pal Andy's probably burning the oil, too."
"I think so. I was supposed to meet her for a drink after work, but she canceled."
"What did you do to her, Holler?"
"Oh, I clipped her wings a little bit at the end of her case, then came out on mine like gangbusters. She's probably trying to figure out how to counter." "Probably."
She went back to her file. I was clearly being wordlessly dismissed. First my daughter, now the ex-wife I still loved. I did not want to go gentle into that good night.
"So what about us?"
I asked.
"What do you mean?"
"You and me. Things didn't end so good the other night at Dantana's." She closed the file, slid it aside, and looked up at me. Finally.
"Some nights are like that. It doesn't change anything."
I pushed off the counter and came to the breakfast bar. I leaned down on two elbows. We were eye to eye.
"So if nothing's changed, then what about us? What are we doing?"
She shrugged.
"I want to try again. I still love you, Mags. You know that. I also know that it didn't work before. We are the kind of people who bring home what we do. It wasn't good."
"I'm beginning to think my client is innocent and that she was set up, and that even with all of that, I still might not be able to get her off. How would you like to bring that home with you?"
"If it bothers you so much, then maybe you should run for DA. The job's open, you know."
"Yeah, maybe I just will."
"Holler for the people."
"Yeah." I hung around for a few minutes after that, but could tell I wasn't making any headway with Maggie. She had a skill for freezing you out and making you feel it. I told her I was going, and to tell Haley I said goodnight. There was no rush to bar the door before I could exit, but Maggie did call one thing after me that made me feel good.
"Just give it time, Michael."
I turned back to her.
"What are you talking about?" "Not what, who. Haley. And me."
I nodded and said I would.
Driving back to my place, I let the accomplishments of the court day boost my spirits. I started thinking about the next witness I planned to put on the stand after Lisa. The task ahead was still formidable, but it didn't help to think that far ahead. You start with a day's momentum and go from there.
I took Beverly Glen up to the top, then drove Mulholland east toward Laurel Canyon. I got glimpses of the city lights both to the north and the south. Los Angeles spread out like a shimmering ocean. I kept the music off and the windows down. I let the chill air work like loneliness into my bones. Chapter 41. All that had been won the day before was lost in a span of 20 minutes Friday morning,
when Andrea Freeman continued her cross-examination of Lisa Trammell. Being sandbagged by the prosecution in the midst of trial is certainly never a good thing, but in many ways it is acceptable as part of the game. It's one of the unknown unknowns. But being sandbagged by your own client is the worst thing that can happen. One of the unknown unknowns should never be the person you are defending. With Trammell in place on the witness stand, Freeman went to the lectern carrying a thick document with crisp edges and one pink post-it sticking out of the pages. I thought it was a prop, designed to distract me, and paid it no mind. She started things off with what I call setup questions. These were designed to get a witness's answers on the record before they were proven false. I could see the trap forming, but wasn't sure where the net was going to fall. Now, you testified yesterday that you did not know Mitchell Bondurant, is that correct? Yes, correct. You never met him? Never. Never spoke to him? Never. But you tried to meet him and speak to him, right? Yes, I went to the bank twice to try to meet him to talk about my home, but he wouldn't see me. Do you remember when you made those efforts? They were last year, but I don't remember the exact dates. Freeman then seemed to shift directions, but I knew it was all part of a careful plan. She asked Trammell a series of seemingly innocuous questions about her flag organization and its purpose. Much of this had already been touched on during my direct examination. I still couldn't see the play. I glanced over at the document with the bright pink post-it and started to believe it was no prop. Maggie had told me yesterday that Freeman was working the night shift. Now I knew why. She had obviously found something. I leaned across the defense table in the direction of the witness stand, as if being closer to the source would speed the arrival of understanding. And you have a website that you use to support the efforts of FLAG, don't you? Freeman asked. Yes, Trammell replied. CaliforniaForeclosureFighters.com. And you are also on Facebook, aren't you? Yes. I could tell by the timid, cautious way in which my client said that one word that this was where the trap was set. It was the first I'd heard of Lisa on Facebook. For those on the jury who might not know, what exactly is Facebook, Miss Trammell? I leaned back in my chair and surreptitiously pulled my phone. I quickly tapped out a text to Bullocks telling her to drop whatever she was doing and see what she could find out about Lisa's Facebook page. See what's there, I said. Well, it's a networking site, and it lets me stay in touch with people involved in FLAG. I post updates on what is happening. I tell them where we are going to meet or march, things like that. People can set it up so they get automatic notifications on their phone or computer whenever I put a post on there. It has been very useful in our organizing. You can post on your Facebook page right from your phone, too, correct? Yes, I can. And this digital location where you make these posts is called your wall, correct? Yes. And you have used your wall to do more than just send out messages about protest marches, haven't you? Sometimes. You gave regular updates on your own foreclosure case as well, didn't you? Yes. I wanted it to be like a personal journal of a foreclosure. Did you also use Facebook to alert the media to your activities? Yes, that too. So, in order to receive this information, someone would have to sign up as a friend, correct? Yes, that's how it works. People who want to friend me make the request, I accept them, and then they have access to my wall. How many friends do you have? I didn't know where this was going, but I knew it wasn't going to be good. I stood and objected, telling the judge that it appeared we were on a fishing expedition with no defined purpose or relevance. Freeman promised that relevance would become clear very soon, and Perry let her go on. You can answer the question, he said to Trammell.
Last time I checked, I had over 1,000. When did you first join Facebook? Last year. I think it was in July or August, when I filed papers for FLAG and started the website. I did it all at once.
So let's make this very clear. As far as the website goes, anybody with a computer and the internet has access, correct?
Right. But your Facebook page is a little more private and personal. To gain access, a person has to be accepted by you as a friend. Is that correct?
Yes, but I generally friend anybody who asks. I don't know them all because there are too many. I just assume they've heard about our good work and are interested. I don't turn anybody down. That's how I got to 1,000 in less than a year.
Okay, and you've been making regular posts on your wall since you joined Facebook, correct?
Pretty regular, yes.
In fact, you've posted updates on this trial, have you not?
Yes, just my opinion of things.
I could feel my temperature rising. My suit was beginning to feel like it was made of plastic and was trapping my body heat inside. I wanted to loosen my tie, but knew if a juror saw such a move during this questioning, it would send a disastrous signal.
Now, can anyone go on the page and post a message under your name?
No, just me. People can respond and make their own posts, but not under my name.
How many posts would you say you've put on your wall since last summer?
I have no idea. A lot.
Freeman held up the thick document with the post-it sticking out.
Would you believe that you've posted more than 1,200 times on your wall?
I don't know.
Well, I do. I have every one of your posts printed right here.
Your Honor, may I approach the witness with this document?
Before the judge could respond, I asked for a sidebar. Perry waved us up. Freeman brought the thick document with her.
Your Honor, what's going on? I said. I have the same objection I did yesterday to the prosecution's deliberate avoidance of discovery.
There has been nothing about this previously, and now she wants to introduce 1,200 Facebook posts? Come on, Judge, this isn't right.
There has been nothing in discovery because this Facebook account was unknown until last night.
Judge, if you believe that, I have some property west of Malibu I'd like to sell you.
Judge, yesterday afternoon, my office came into possession of a printout of all posts made by the defendant to her Facebook page. I was pointed to a set of posts from last September that are relevant to this case and the defendant's own testimony. If I can be allowed to proceed, this will become very obvious, even to counsel.
Came into possession, I said. What's that mean?
Judge, you have to be an invited friend to see my client's Facebook wall. If the government engaged in subter... It was given to me by a member of the media who is friends with the defendant on Facebook.
Freeman interjected.
There was no subterfuge, but its source should not be at issue here. The document speaks for itself, Judge, and I am sure the defendant can identify her own Facebook posts for the jury. Counsel is simply engaged in trying to prevent the jurors from seeing what he knows is evidence of his client's...
Judge, I have no idea what she's even talking about. The first I heard about a Facebook page was during her cross. Counsel's view of...
Very well, Ms. Freeman, Perry interrupted. Give her the document, but get to the point quickly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As I sat back down, I felt my phone vibrate in my pocket. I pulled it and read the text under the table and out of the judge's view. It was from Bullock's, and she simply said she had access to Lisa's Facebook wall and was working on my request. I typed with one hand, telling her to check the posts from September, then pocketed the phone. Freeman gave Trammell the printout and had her verify the most recent posts as coming from her Facebook wall.
Thank you, Miss Trammell. Could you now go to the page I have marked with the post-it?
Lisa reluctantly did as instructed.
You will see that I have highlighted a series of three of your posts from last September 7th. Could you please read the first one to the jury, including the time of the posting?
1:46? I am heading into Westland to see Bondurant. This time, I'm not taking no for an answer.
Now, you just pronounced the name Bondurant, but it is misspelled, is it not, in the post?
Yes.
How is it spelled in your post?
B-O-N-D-U-R-U-N-T.
Bondurant. I notice that the name is spelled that way on all posts in which he is mentioned. Was that intentional or a mistake?
He was taking away my house.
Could you please answer the question?
Yes, it was intentional. I called him Bondurant because he was not a good man.
I could feel the sweat moving through my hair. The hidden Lisa was about to come out.
Could you please read the next highlighted post, with the time?
2:18. They wouldn't let me see him again. So unfair.
And now please read the next post and time.
2:21. Found his spot. I'm going to wait for him in the garage.
The quiet in the courtroom was as loud as a train.
Miss Trammell, did you wait for Mitchell Bondurant in the parking garage at Westland National on September 7th of last year?
Yes, but not that long. I realized it was dumb, and he wouldn't even be out until the end of the day, so I left.
Did you go back to that garage and wait for him on the morning of his murder?
No, I didn't. I wasn't there.
You saw him in the coffee shop. You became enraged and knew just where he would be, didn't you? You went to the garage and waited for him, and then...
Objection! I yelled.
You killed him with the hammer, didn't you?
No, no, no!
Trammell yelled.
I didn't do it!
She burst into tears, loudly moaning like some kind of cornered animal.
Your Honor, objection! She's badgering the...
Perry seemed to snap out of some reverie as he watched Trammell.
Sustained!
Freeman stopped. The courtroom was again silent, except for the sound of my client sobbing. The courtroom deputy came over with a box of tissues, and Lisa's tears finally subsided.
Thank you, Your Honor, Freeman finally said. I have no further questions.
I asked for an early morning break so my client could compose herself and I'd have time to decide whether to continue on redirect. The judge granted the request, probably because he felt sorry for me. Lisa's tears did not undercut the fact that Freeman had been masterful in setting her trap. But all was not lost. The best thing about a setup defense is that almost every piece of damning evidence or testimony, even when it comes from your own client, can become part of the setup. After the jury was let out, I walked up to the witness stand to console my client. I pulled two tissues out of the box and handed them to her. She took them and started dabbing her eyes. I cupped my hand over the microphone so as not to broadcast our conversation across the courtroom. I tried my best to control my tone. Lisa, why the hell am I finding out about Facebook now? Do you have any idea what this could do to our case?
I thought you knew. I friended Jennifer.
My Jennifer?
Yes.
Nothing like having both your junior associate and your client know more than you. But what about these posts from September? Do you know how damaging they are?
I'm sorry. I totally forgot about them. They were so long ago.
It looked like another cascade of tears was coming. I tried to head it off. Well, we're lucky. We might be able to make this work for us. She stopped dabbing at her face with the tissue and looked at me.
Really?
Maybe, but I need to go outside and call Bullocks.
Who's Bullocks?
Sorry, it's what we call Jennifer. You sit tight and pull yourself together.
Am I going to be asked more questions?
Yes, I want to do some redirect.
Then can I go fix my face?
That's a good idea. Just don't take long. I finally got out to the hallway and called Bullocks at the office. Did you see the entries on September 7th? I asked by way of a greeting.
Just saw them. If Freeman...
She already did.
Shit.
Yeah, well, it was bad, but there might be a way out. Lisa said you're her friend on Facebook?
Yes, and I'm sorry. I knew she had a page. It never occurred to me to go back and look at previous posts on her wall.
We'll talk about it later. Right now, I need to know if you have access to her list of friends.
I'm looking at it right now.
Okay, first, I want you to print out all the names, give them to Lorna, and have Rojas drive her over here with them. Right away. Then I want you and Cisco to start working the names yourselves. Find out who these people are.
There's more than 1,000. You want us to run them all down?
If you have to. I'm looking for a connection to Aparicio.
Aparicio? Why would...
Trammell was a threat to him, just like she was a threat to the bank. She was protesting fraud in foreclosure. The fraud was being committed by Aparicio's company. We know through Herb Dahl that she was on Aparicio's radar. It stands to reason that somebody in that company was checking on her through Facebook. Lisa just testified that she accepted anybody who asked to friend her. Maybe we'll get lucky and find a name we know. There was a silence, and then Bullock's tumbled to what I was thinking.
By tracking her on Facebook, they would know what she was up to.
And they could have known that at one time she waited for Bondurant in the garage.
And then they could have constructed his murder around that record.
Bullocks, I hate to tell you this, but you're thinking like a defense lawyer.
We'll get right on this.
I could hear the urgency in her voice. Good, but first print that list and get it over to me. I start redirect in about 15 minutes. Tell Lorna to walk it right into me. Then if you and Cisco find something, text it to me right away.
You got it.
Chapter 42. Freeman was still swelling with pride over her morning victory when I got back to the courtroom. She sauntered over, folded her arms, and leaned her hip against the defense table.
Holler, tell me that was just an act, you not knowing about the Facebook page.
Sorry, I can't tell you that. She rolled her eyes.
Uh-oh, sounds like somebody needs a client who isn't hiding things. Or maybe a new investigator who can find them.
I ignored the taunt, hoping she would stop gloating and go back to her table. I started flipping through the pages of a legal pad, pretending I was looking for something.
That was like manna from heaven last night when I got that printout and read those posts.
You must have been very pleased with yourself. Which asshole reporter gave it to you?
Wouldn't you like to know?
I will know. Whichever one breaks out the next exclusive from the DA's office will be the one who helped you out. They'll never get so much as a no comment from me. She chuckled. My threat had nothing to do with her. She had gotten the posts out before the jury, and nothing else mattered. I finally looked up at her and squinted.
You don't get it, do you?
Get what? That the jury now knows your client was previously at the scene of the crime? Proving that she had knowledge of where to find the victim?
No, I completely get that.
I looked away and shook my head. You'll see. Excuse me. I stood up and headed toward the witness stand. Lisa Trammell had just returned from the restroom. She had redrawn the makeup on her eyes. When she started to speak, I cupped the microphone again.
What were you doing talking to that bitch? She's a horrible person, she said.
A bit stunned by the unbridled anger, I looked back at Freeman, now sitting at the prosecution table. She's not horrible, and she's not a bitch, okay? She's just doing...
Yes, she is. You don't know.
I leaned close to her and whispered.
And what, you do? Look, Lisa, don't go bipolar on me. You've got less than a half hour of testimony still to go. Let's just get through it without cluing the jury into your issues. Okay?
I don't know what you're talking about, but it's very hurtful.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to defend you, and it doesn't help me to have to find out about things like Facebook when you're being cross-examined by the prosecution.
I told you I'm sorry, but your associate knew.
Yeah, well, I didn't.
Look, you said before that you might be able to make this work in our favor. How?
Simple. If someone was going to set you up, this Facebook page would have been a damn good place to start.
Talk about manna from heaven. Her eyes looked upward, and pure relief colored her face as she came to understand the tactic I was about to employ. The anger that had darkened her expression only a minute before was now completely gone. It was just then that the judge entered the courtroom, ready to go. I nodded to my client and went back to the defense table, as the judge instructed the deputy to bring in the jury. Once everyone was situated, the judge asked if I wished to question my client on redirect examination. I jumped up from my seat like I had been waiting 10 years for the opportunity. It cost me. A jolt of pain moved like lightning across my torso. The ribs may have mended, but the wrong move still lit me up.
Just as I walked to the lectern, the rear door of the courtroom opened and Lorna came in. Perfect timing. Carrying a file and a motorcycle helmet, she walked swiftly down the center aisle to the gate.
Your Honor, could I have a moment with my associate?
Make it fast, please.
I met Lorna at the gate and she handed over the file.
That's the list of all her Facebook friends. But as of when I left, Dennis and Jennifer hadn't found any connection to you-know-who.
It was strange hearing Cisco and Bullocks referred to by their real names. I looked down at the helmet she carried. I whispered,
You rode Cisco's motorcycle over here?
You wanted it quick, and I knew I could park up close.
Where's Rojas?
I don't know. He didn't answer his cell.
Great. Listen, I want you to leave Cisco's bike where it is and walk back to the office. I don't want you riding that suicide machine.
I'm not your wife anymore. I'm his.
Just as she whispered this, I looked over her shoulder and saw Maggie McPherson sitting in the gallery. I wondered if she was there for me or for Freeman.
Look, I said, that's got nothing to do with
Mr. Haller,
the judge intoned from behind me. We're waiting.
Yes, Your Honor,
I said loudly without turning around. Then in a whisper to Lorna, I said, walk back.
I returned to the lectern. Opening the file. It contained nothing more than raw data, 1,000-plus names, listed in 2 columns per page. But I looked at it as if I had just been given the Holy Grail.
Okay, Lisa, let's talk about your Facebook page. You testified earlier that you have more than 1,000 friends. Are all of these people personally known to you?
No, not at all. Because so many people know about me through Flag, I just assume that when someone wants to friend me, they are supportive of that cause. I just accept them.
So then the posts on your wall are open to a significant number of people who are Facebook friends, but in reality complete strangers to you. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
I felt my phone vibrate in my pocket. So any one of these strangers who is interested in your movements, past or present, could just go to your Facebook page and see the posts on your wall, am I right?
Yes, that's right.
For example, someone could go to that page right now and scroll through your updates and see that back in September of last year, you hung out in the garage at Westland, waiting for Mitchell Bondurant, correct?
Yes, they could.
I pulled my phone out of my pocket and using the lectern as a blind, brought it up and put it down on the work surface. While using one hand to leaf through the printout of names, I used the other to open the text I had just received. The message was from Bullocks. Third page, right column, fifth from bottom. Don Driscoll. We have a Donald Driscoll as former aloft in IT. We're working on it. Bingo. Now I had something I could hit out of the park. Your Honor, I would like to show the witness this document. It is a printout of the names of people who have friended Lisa Trammell on Facebook. Freeman, seeing her victorious morning in jeopardy, objected, but the judge overruled without argument from me, saying Freeman had opened this door herself. I gave my client the list and returned to the lectern. Can you please go to the third page of the printout and read the name that is fifth up from the bottom in the right side column? Freeman objected again, stating that the list was unverified. The judge advised her to challenge it on recross if she thought I was introducing a bogus exhibit. I told Lisa she could read the name.
Don Driscoll.
Thank you. Now is that name familiar to you?
Not really, no.
But he is one of your Facebook friends.
I know, but like I said, I don't know everybody who friends me. There are too many.
Well, do you recall if Don Driscoll ever contacted you directly and identified himself as working for a company called Aloft? Freeman objected and asked for a sidebar. We were called to the bench.
Judge, what's going on here? Counsel can't just throw names around. I want an offer of proof that he isn't just throwing darts at the list and picking out a name.
Perry nodded thoughtfully.
I agree, Mr. Haller.
My phone was still on the lectern. If I'd gotten any updates from Bullocks, they weren't going to help me now.
Judge, we could go into chambers and get my investigator on the phone if you wish, but I would ask the court for some leeway here.